Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2024. English for speakers of other languages. Higher. Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 1 before the recording begins.
Hello listeners, this is Rachel Woods and I'd like to welcome you to episode 43 of your favourite weekly podcast, CyberSafe. Over the past decade or so, now that society relies on the internet for almost everything, the number of us falling victim to cybercrime has escalated, with over 45 million people being targeted in 2021 alone. Our guest today, Jim Browning, decided that enough was enough. Sick to the back teeth with the endless stream of spam emails and fraudulent calls, he chose to fight back. Perhaps surprisingly, the tactic Jim employs is to actually allow himself to be scammed, and then he turns the tables. If someone hacks into his machine, they leave themselves vulnerable to him being able to hack into theirs. Not only that, but he also gains access to grainy CCTV footage from inside the call centres where the scammers work. Browning records videos of his crime-fighting exploits, which make for bizarrely gripping viewing, posting them on his social media platforms for all to see. Jim joins us today to delve into the dark world of cybercrime to understand how we can protect ourselves. So, Jim, should we all be able to spot a scam a mile off?
Not at all. The scams themselves are often ingenious. It's no surprise that many fall victim to them. The advice is usually, ignore them and hang up. But I thought with my background in IT, surely I could do something about these calls. I've become somewhat of an expert at playing dumb to give the cybercriminals a false sense of security. Their main weakness, though, is the fact that they will attempt to connect to the device I'm using. And when they do, I can find out where they're from and call them by their real name. I even have pictures of them displayed as my desktop background. That usually catches them unawares when they try to take control of my computer.
The scams and the people behind them are clearly very intelligent. What sense do you have of the perpetrators?
You get the odd one or two who will be frank and open with you. If you ask, look, why are you doing this? It's a scam. They will give you loads of different reasons. The main one is high unemployment, low wages. But in reality, the people working in scam call centres come from all walks of life. Of course, everybody has their own story about why they got into it, but at the end of the day, it is really just about greed. I can see what they do on their computers, and there are very few people who actually seem to be on the breadline.
Who's most likely to be targeted for scams?
Certainly, older people are the prime target for most of these scam calls. I've seen scammers take lists and filter them for people over 60 because that's the demographic where they see the most favourable results. But in some countries, their market is getting smaller. For example, most Brits are so used to receiving these calls, they know just to hang up immediately. So the scammers are having to branch out. I'm monitoring a group at the moment who are targeting Norway. And although they can't speak Norwegian, they are still attempting the same scam in English in the hope that they can track down some unfortunate soul who'll fall for it.
And it really can be anyone, can't it? In fact, you were recently a victim of a scam yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's right. Luckily for me, the damage wasn't permanent. But yes, absolutely, anyone can be scammed. The circumstances just have to be right. Funnily enough, it would appear that this particular person didn't actually know who I was, so it can't have been a revenge attack. They tried to take over my social media channel, basically to steal the revenue that I get. They'd found a flaw in the chat services and were able to make it look like a legitimate email coming from the company. So, initially, I did fall for this. I never lost control of the channel, and they didn't manage to get a penny from me, but they did convince me to delete the entire account.
Well, it just goes to show we all need to be on our guard. Thanks for coming in today, Jim. For more information about how to protect yourself from scams, visit www. Hello listeners, this is Rachel Woods and I'd like to welcome you to episode 43 of your favourite weekly podcast, CyberSafe. Over the past decade or so, now that society relies on the internet for almost everything, the number of us falling victim to cybercrime has escalated, with over 45 million people being targeted in 2021 alone. Our guest today, Jim Browning, decided that enough was enough. Sick to the back teeth with the endless stream of spam emails and fraudulent calls, he chose to fight back. Perhaps surprisingly, the tactic Jim employs is to actually allow himself to be scammed, and then he turns the tables. If someone hacks into his machine, they leave themselves vulnerable to him being able to hack into theirs. Not only that, but he also gains access to grainy CCTV footage from inside the call centres where the scammers work. Browning records videos of his crime-fighting exploits, which make for bizarrely gripping viewing, posting them on his social media platforms for all to see. Jim joins us today to delve into the dark world of cybercrime to understand how we can protect ourselves. So, Jim, should we all be able to spot a scam a mile off?
Not at all. The scams themselves are often ingenious. It's no surprise that many fall victim to them. The advice is usually, ignore them and hang up. But I thought with my background in IT, surely I could do something about these calls. I've become somewhat of an expert at playing dumb to give the cybercriminals a false sense of security. Their main weakness, though, is the fact that they will attempt to connect to the device I'm using. And when they do, I can find out where they're from and call them by their real name. I even have pictures of them displayed as my desktop background. That usually catches them unawares when they try to take control of my computer.
The scams and the people behind them are clearly very intelligent. What sense do you have of the perpetrators?
You get the odd one or two who will be frank and open with you. If you ask, look, why are you doing this? It's a scam. They will give you loads of different reasons. The main one is high unemployment, low wages. But in reality, the people working in scam call centres come from all walks of life. Of course, everybody has their own story about why they got into it, but at the end of the day, it is really just about greed. I can see what they do on their computers, and there are very few people who actually seem to be on the breadline.
Who's most likely to be targeted for scams?
Certainly, older people are the prime target for most of these scam calls. I've seen scammers take lists and filter them for people over 60 because that's the demographic where they see the most favourable results. But in some countries, their market is getting smaller. For example, most Brits are so used to receiving these calls, they know just to hang up immediately. So the scammers are having to branch out. I'm monitoring a group at the moment who are targeting Norway. And although they can't speak Norwegian, they are still attempting the same scam in English in the hope that they can track down some unfortunate soul who'll fall for it.
And it really can be anyone, can't it? In fact, you were recently a victim of a scam yourself, weren't you?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's right. Luckily for me, the damage wasn't permanent. But yes, absolutely, anyone can be scammed. The circumstances just have to be right. Funnily enough, it would appear that this particular person didn't actually know who I was, so it can't have been a revenge attack. They tried to take over my social media channel, basically to steal the revenue that I get. They'd found a flaw in the chat services and were able to make it look like a legitimate email coming from the company. So, initially, I did fall for this. I never lost control of the channel, and they didn't manage to get a penny from me, but they did convince me to delete the entire account.
Well, it just goes to show we all need to be on our guard. Thanks for coming in today, Jim. For more information about how to protect yourself from scams, visit www.
Recording 2. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 2 before the recording begins.
Okay, so coming up in 20 minutes or so, your most embarrassing moments at work. But first, if you don't know me, I'm Tony Davies on Radio Kelvin, and I want to explore with my two guests the world of employee activism. Chief Executive of Northern Infotech, Carolina Novak, and Steve Swindon, one of three managing partners of Ultra Fresh Smoothies. Welcome both.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, Tony.
So, Steve, what's an employee activist? And who decides? Do you recruit them or do they apply to you?
An employee activist is someone who's trying to make the world a better place in terms of all kinds of things in the context of their work. It might mean, for instance, someone who wants to promote equality and diversity in the workplace. It might mean someone who's interested in changing conditions to be more staff-friendly. Or perhaps someone who's making the company greener in some way. And there are no written rules in terms of who makes the first move. People come to us and we come to them. We see how our employee activists can make a difference and we make sure they're free to do that.
Okay. Carolina, what does employee activism mean to you?
Well, employee activist, it's a contradiction, isn't it? An employee is someone who does what the boss tells them, but an activist is someone who doesn't. It's someone, generally, who's lying on the road, wearing a woolly hat and holding up traffic, ruining everyone's day.
Okay, not pulling your punches there, are you? So, Steve, employee activism is a bit of a recipe for angry protests and general disaster. Is that right?
Well, what I thought was going to happen was a proper discussion about the ins and outs of this idea, rather than an argument with someone you clearly picked off the street at the last moment when your actual planned guest couldn't show.
That's not quite right.
But I'm happy to argue my case anyway. Some employee activists may be wearing woolly hats, and others may be wearing business suits. But actually, both kinds and everyone in between can be good for business. They save us money.
Sounds unlikely.
Well, it's true. Firstly, a lot of the work they do to enhance a company's public image has previously been done by consultants who charge eye-watering fees. Secondly, they can point out things that are wrong in the way that the company treats its workforce. So you don't get the costly legal fees incurred when a staff member gets angry and takes the company to court. Thirdly, the environmentally focused kind of activist can identify energy savings at work, so our bills are lower.
Steve, you're implying here that you've never had a major bust-up with an employee activist, that everyone's holding hands together and gets on just fine.
No, I haven't said that. As soon as you start employing people, there's a potential for disagreement. You have managers and human resources departments to help sort them out if they become major disagreements. And yes, when you have employee activists, some of them are very critical of the company. So employers have to take into account what people say and work out carefully where criticisms are justified. For example, we had to review our interviews process to make sure that it was more welcoming to certain minorities. So sometimes the company needs to change. Other times, the criticisms aren't justified. So the member of staff has to be persuaded to change their mind. In a couple of cases, the critical person left the company. But in general, they stay with us. We learn from each other. And a disagreement doesn't mean a crisis.
Carolina, are you still maintaining you've nothing to learn from the experiments of leaders like Steve? Aren't you a bit stuck in the dark ages?
Not at all. At Northern Infotech, we've got a big mix of ethnicities. Women are very well represented. We follow all employment laws and we recognise a trade union. But if someone wants to manage our company for us, they can apply for a manager's job, rather than wearing a little badge with the word activist on it and jumping up and down shouting about love and peace. Frankly, they're not welcome at Northern Infotech.
Steve, has Carolina got a point?
Well, no, she hasn't. So what if Carolina does the things she mentioned? It's really basic stuff. Most activists don't want to be managers. They contribute in all sorts of ways that generally don't involve spreadsheets. Let me tell you this. Activism is more dynamic than management.
Interesting. Well, we need to leave it there for today, but I'd like to thank Carolina and Steve for coming on the show. Okay, so coming up in 20 minutes or so, your most embarrassing moments at work. But first, if you don't know me, I'm Tony Davies on Radio Kelvin, and I want to explore with my two guests the world of employee activism. Chief Executive of Northern Infotech, Carolina Novak, and Steve Swindon, one of three managing partners of Ultra Fresh Smoothies. Welcome both.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers, Tony.
So, Steve, what's an employee activist? And who decides? Do you recruit them or do they apply to you?
An employee activist is someone who's trying to make the world a better place in terms of all kinds of things in the context of their work. It might mean, for instance, someone who wants to promote equality and diversity in the workplace. It might mean someone who's interested in changing conditions to be more staff friendly. Or perhaps someone who's making the company greener in some way. And there are no written rules in terms of who makes the first move. People come to us and we come to them. We see how our employee activists can make a difference and we make sure they're free to do that.
Okay. Carolina, what does employee activism mean to you?
Well, Employee activist. It's a contradiction, isn't it? An employee is someone who does what the boss tells them, but an activist is someone who doesn't. It's someone, generally, who's lying on the road, wearing a woolly hat and holding up traffic, ruining everyone's day.
Okay, not pulling your punches there, are you? So, Steve, employee activism is a bit of a recipe for angry protests and general disaster. Is that right?
Well, what I thought was going to happen was a proper discussion about the ins and outs of this idea, rather than an argument with someone you clearly picked off the street at the last moment when your actual planned guest couldn't show.
That's not quite right.
But I'm happy to argue my case anyway. Some employee activists may be wearing woolly hats, and others may be wearing business suits. But actually, both kinds and everyone in between can be good for business. They save us money.
Sounds unlikely.
Well, it's true. Firstly, a lot of the work they do to enhance a company's public image has previously been done by consultants who charge eye-watering fees. Secondly, they can point out things that are wrong in the way that the company treats its workforce, so you don't get the costly legal fees incurred when a staff member gets angry and takes the company to court. Thirdly, the environmentally focused kind of activist can identify energy savings at work, so our bills are lower.
Steve, you're implying here that you've never had a major bust-up with an employee activist, that everyone's holding hands together and gets on just fine.
No, I haven't said that. As soon as you start employing people, there's a potential for disagreement. You have managers and human resources departments to help sort them out if they become major disagreements. And yes, when you have employee activists, some of them are very critical of the company. So employers have to take into account what people say and work out carefully where criticisms are justified. For example, we had to review our interviews process to make sure that it was more welcoming to certain minorities. So sometimes the company needs to change. Other times, the criticisms aren't justified. So the member of staff has to be persuaded to change their mind. In a couple of cases, the critical person left the company. But in general, they stay with us. We learn from each other. And a disagreement doesn't mean a crisis.
Carolina, are you still maintaining you've nothing to learn from the experiments of leaders like Steve? Aren't you a bit stuck in the dark ages?
Not at all. At Northern Infotech, we've got a big mix of ethnicities. Women are very well represented. We follow all employment laws and we recognise a trade union. But if someone wants to manage our company for us, they can apply for a manager's job, rather than wearing a little badge with the word activist on it and jumping up and down shouting about love and peace. Frankly, they're not welcome at Northern Infotech.
Steve, has Carolina got a point?
Well, no, she hasn't. So what if Carolina does the things she mentioned? It's really basic stuff. Most activists don't want to be managers. They contribute in all sorts of ways that generally don't involve spreadsheets. Let me tell you this. Activism is more dynamic than management.
Interesting. Well, we need to leave it there for today, but I'd like to thank Carolina and Steve for coming on the show.
Recording 3. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording three before the recording begins.
Good morning, and thanks for inviting me to share my experiences today. My name is Marion Turner, and I've been the head teacher of Newbank Academy for 20 years now. We are about as inner city as a school can be. It's an urban environment with only two small areas of green space nearby. Being enclosed by multi-story buildings blocking our view of anything beyond the concrete horizon, I feel, has the potential to be a metaphor for how our pupils' perception of life can become restricted. Existing in this bubble, they often have little knowledge or understanding of the prospects the world has to offer them. It can be tricky to convince students that learning and teaching doesn't have to take place in the classroom. But when I took on the headteacher role, I was determined to organise a programme of residential visits in an effort to provide an alternative perspective to our young learners regarding what constitutes an appropriate learning environment. To be truly effective, it is not enough to let them merely observe the countryside. What it requires is for them to immerse themselves in a natural environment where they can actively experience such things as sailing, rowing, climbing, and hiking. In my experience, this affects a great change in young people. The residential trips always prove to be a learning experience for everyone involved, including the parents. Though you might assume they'd be glad of the break from childcare responsibilities, it is not always easy to persuade parents of the huge benefits of outdoor residential courses. I have experienced parental resistance because residentials are simply alien experiences. Despite admitting that their offspring would likely relish the experience, they can become very anxious that bad things will happen. In fact, the opposite is true. Allowing children to manage risk and cope with new outdoor learning situations helps to ensure they grow into capable adults. Each year, to address any concerns and help them focus on the experience ahead, we give pupils and parents the opportunity to attend weekly Q&A sessions. We actively encourage the young people and their parents to visit the residential centre's website so they can familiarise themselves with the Lake District environment and the extremes of weather they're likely to experience. Naturally, we offer practical suggestions relating to things like what clothing and equipment to bring, how we will travel to and from the location, and we give drop-off and pick-up times with plenty of notice so parents can arrange their schedules. All the young folks seem to be concerned with, though, is whether they'll get to stay up later than they do at home. We usually get some queries from more nervous parents about the procedures if a student gets sick or has an accident, and there are always some kids who are fussy eaters who will demand to know what they'll get at mealtimes. In reality, I've never found this to be an issue. The children are usually starving after a busy day of activities, so they just get on with eating whatever's put in front of them. Mobile phone use is another point that's raised regularly by both parties. There's very little signal in the area, and parents want to feel reassured that their child will have the means to reach them should they need to. Needless to say, this is something that we will facilitate, but the situation comes up less frequently than you might think. The students, on the other hand, have a different priority, whether they'll still be able to access their social media accounts. For the record, the answer to the latter is no. In my mind, there is absolutely no doubt that these courses are transformational and that these transformations and tangible life experiences remain with our students once they return home and back to school. Good morning, and thanks for inviting me to share my experiences today. My name is Marion Turner, and I have been the head teacher of New Bank Academy for 20 years now. We are about as inner city as a school can be. It's an urban environment with only two small areas of green space nearby. Being enclosed by multi-storey buildings blocking our view of anything beyond the concrete horizon, I feel, has the potential to be a metaphor for how our pupils' perception of life can become restricted. Existing in this bubble, they often have little knowledge or understanding of the prospects the world has to offer them. It can be tricky to convince students that learning and teaching doesn't have to take place in the classroom. But when I took on the headteacher role, I was determined to organise a programme of residential visits in an effort to provide an alternative perspective to our young learners regarding what constitutes an appropriate learning environment. To be truly effective, it is not enough to let them merely observe the countryside. What it requires is for them to immerse themselves in a natural environment where they can actively experience such things as sailing, rowing, climbing, and hiking. In my experience, this affects a great change in young people. The residential trips always prove to be a learning experience for everyone involved, including the parents. Though you might assume they'd be glad of the break from childcare responsibilities, it is not always easy to persuade parents of the huge benefits of outdoor residential courses. I have experienced parental resistance because residentials are simply alien experiences. Despite admitting that their offspring would likely relish the experience, they can become very anxious that bad things will happen. In fact, the opposite is true. Allowing children to manage risk and cope with new outdoor learning situations helps to ensure they grow into capable adults. Each year, to address any concerns and help them focus on the experience ahead, we give pupils and parents the opportunity to attend weekly Q&A sessions. We actively encourage the young people and their parents to visit the residential centre's website so they can familiarise themselves with the Lake District environment and the extremes of weather they're likely to experience. Naturally, we offer practical suggestions relating to things like what clothing and equipment to bring, how we will travel to and from the location, and we give drop-off and pick-up times with plenty of notice so parents can arrange their schedules. All the young folks seem to be concerned with, though, is whether they'll get to stay up later than they do at home. We usually get some queries from more nervous parents about the procedures if a student gets sick or has an accident, and there are always some kids who are fussy eaters who will demand to know what they'll get at mealtimes. In reality, I've never found this to be an issue. The children are usually starving after a busy day of activities, so they just get on with eating whatever's put in front of them. Mobile phone use is another point that's raised regularly by both parties. There's very little signal in the area, and parents want to feel reassured that their child will have the means to reach them should they need to. Needless to say, this is something that we will facilitate, but the situation comes up less frequently than you might think. The students, on the other hand, have a different priority, whether they'll still be able to access their social media accounts. For the record, the answer to the latter is no. In my mind, there is absolutely no doubt that these courses are transformational and that these transformations and tangible life experiences remain with our students once they return home and back to school.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the listening test.